Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things with Gawker, I remember, was I remember when they were establishing a union, Hamilton Nolan, who is releasing a book soon about unions, too. Like, he mostly just up on the union beat now. But back then, he was organizing the Gawker union. And he talked about how, like, things are good now. Things are really good now. And, like, it might seem counterintuitive. Like, yeah, we don't need a union because everything is great. And, like, it's a good place to work. We get paid well and everything. And we have a lot of them. It's like that can change very quickly, and then of course it fucking did.
yeah,
and they got screwed anyway. But I guess some of them got severance at least when they got kicked out.
Okay, well that's something.
Who got fired?
The Gawker writers.
Oh god,
Gawker's unions.
Gawker's down again.
Yeah. Well, it is down again, isn't it?
Yeah, I joined a union. I'm in a union now. So.
I don't even think my workplace has a union. Like, I think CBS did, but freelance writing is hard to unionize.
Oh yeah, yeah, I would imagine so. Yeah, I had to get a job at the state to do that.
I mean,
it's
guess
a good,
like,
one to unionize.
Yeah,
all of the Writers Guild and like the Screen Actors Guild and stuff—that's all basically freelance, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's like a possibility, but. It would take a lot of organization for people as low, have that much trouble getting jobs to begin
with. Yeah. It's weird that they separate it by like industry. Cause like, I feel like the WGA should also be able to like umbrella over other types of writing.
Yeah.
I think you know? That's what Gawker.
I would love if WGA was one of the most complicated unions that I've ever seen. Like, I tried to like look at it and I don't know. Did you see any of the movies this weekend, Brandon?
Did I see any movies this weekend?
Yeah.
No. Oh, no, no, no. We're going to go see that on Tuesday because it's cheap.
What is that?
What's that?
What is that? There's multiple films out right now.
Both.
Both? You're going to see both?
Both. Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't seen Barbie yet, but I've seen Oppenheimer.
How is it? Don't say nothing, but like.
No, I liked it. It was a pretty like good like visual effects movie. Rob and I have been chatting privately because we didn't want to spoil you about some people complaining about it. But like.
Nice.
But like no, and I have to wait to see Barbie till like my kids are in Nashville this week. That's why I'm in a different room because nobody will come yell at.
Oh yeah, you're in the living room.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. So like, and they asked me to wait with to see the.
So
Barbie
when are they coming? When are they coming back?
They get back on Sunday night.
Cool.
So I'll no, it's too.
You'll
late
still have seen it before I have. Yeah,
that's true.
Because I'm going on, Super Saver Tuesday.
Are you buying tickets now? Don't those sell out usually?
What's that? Oh, we got them already. We're good.
Okay, good.
Yeah. We're square. So
are you seeing Oppenheimer?
I'm excited. I just like I honestly don't give a shit about the plot at all for either of them.
Like, it doesn't matter.
It's not much for a
Barbie. I know the history. I know the toy.
Yeah.
I really like the
Yeah, that's why I'm seeing it in theaters, because if I don't see these things in theaters, I'm not going to fucking watch them, because I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I want the spectacle.
Yeah, I mean, Oppenheimer especially, it's all about the spectacle. I mean,
they
handle the bomb really in a really cool way.
I just hope people are still wearing pink to Barbie when I go see it, like on a fucking like Monday.
They will, Monday. But it'll be all like dirty sweatpants and just a bunch of pink nursing scrubs because they're like they're doing it between shifts.
We took a picture. Like, there were so many people in pink when I went to see Oppenheimer.
Yeah,
that, like, and there was like a group of teenage
inside Oppenheimer.
No, just outside the theater. That would have been funny.
Were they at least in gray in Oppenheimer?
Yeah.
They were?
There were people wearing trail bathing shit at mine.
I feel like it's just generally because the people who like were really excited for Oppenheimer like don't dress nice.
Yeah. I took a couple of pictures of like teenage girls who had come like as a team to all dressed in pink.
Yeah, my girlfriend did that too. And my sister also did that when they went to see Barbie. I saw their outfits.
Oh, wait, who are you going to Barbie with?
Oh, my girlfriend.
Yeah. Is she going again?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Ty sent me a text to remind me. Now he can overhear me. He said there was a girl in cowboy Barbie cosplay at Oppenheimer.
Nice.
Well, if they're seeing both, I mean, what are they going to do? Change in the bathroom?
That would be, yeah, that would be fucking mimi. Either go all the way or don't go.
Did you all see the link I sent you where they played Oppenheimer but with Barbie subtitles?
No, that's awesome. Did they actually do that, or is it like a meme?
No, they did it. It was a fucking article. Hold on. If you go to the article, there's a link to a tweet where they had a screenshot. It had Oppenheimer on the screen, and it was just like, hey, Barbie, what's up?
I just want a showing where it's like one superimposed on the other.
Well, there was the hard drive article that said for people with ADD, they're going
to play next to each other.
And then also like one of those mobile phone games on the third.
Yeah, yeah. I want it overlaid though, like shining forward and backward. Yeah.
Where's that?
Where's I want to see how often the cowboy has a line.
Where's Kelly, Rob?
I didn't send it to her. Yeah, I'm sending it to her now.
Oh my god, she's so responsible, and her podcast is so well run. She's probably like, "What kind of trash like is this?"
I told her I'd send it when you guys are ready.
She's slumming it. I hope she knows she's slumming it. This is like
I told her that it wasn't.
This
like
is late night eats right here.
Yeah. What's late night eats? Is that
this is like this is the taco cart that like that's only out for like 15 minutes at 3.
I thought it was like a Food Network show or something.
No, we're like the fucking like third shift taco stand.
Hi.
Hi, Kelly.
Hello.
Hi.
We don't normally do introductions, but since Jennifer is already upset because you're very professional, I will say that I'm Rob, that's Brandon, and of course you know Jennifer.
I'm very professional. This is news to me.
Well, I mean, I got that impression listening to your guys' show. Like, I was actually curious because you have that, what's your show called? Indubitably? Like,
Indubitably, the debate podcast.
And this is Kelly. We intro our guest.
Yeah, we'll do that now, I guess.
We set a very low bar, professionalism.
Is that, I forgot, I meant to ask too, is that Monty Python? Is that what that's from? Indubitably? Or is that?
I don't think we had a specific cultural reference we were going off of. I think we were just doing like faux pretentiousness. Maybe it wasn't very faux.
I'm going to tell you where I think it's a reference from, and I hope you're not mad at yourself when you find out why. There's an episode of Family Guy where Peter is pretending to be British, and he's just going, he's like smoking a cigar. He's like, indubitably. He's just like saying it over and over again.
Honestly, knowing my co-host Josh and his media preferences, that's probably more accurate than me know. So, yes.
I mean, you guys do sound very professional, and I also was curious, you guys like really nail that NPR sort of voice.
That's probably just our debate voices. We've been competitors for like 20 years plus.
You've been debating for 20 years plus?
Like in like competitive debate.
Like Ben Shapiro?
Are they tournaments? I don't know what you call those.
Not Ben Shapiro. No, I started debating in high school when I was 16, and did a very long path through college to debate as long as possible competitively. And then I coached for a while too, and I still go back and occasionally like lead exercises or drills or what have you, but I judge a lot of tournaments, usually like one or two big tournaments a year. And Josh has a pretty similar background, but he's also done communication education. So he's been a lot more active on the teaching side of things than I have in the last like 5-10 years.
Wow. I started debating when I was like 4 or 5 in my family, and they and we fucking argue about not even like yelling over dumb shit, just literally debating. Like people in my family just fucking debate constantly, but doing it professionally is really intimidating to me. Like, even debate club gave me anxiety, even though I fucking like am so used to like I can have discourse with anybody, I can debate anything with people like one-on-one conversation wise, but like the idea of doing it like on stage and with like somebody I don't know is really scary to me.
It's a pretty big adjustment for people who go from like a casually argumentative hobby to a format that has like set rules, expectations. You don't know the other person. I often hear the, well, I would be a good debater if I could just learn to stop crying whenever I got into an argument. Like, that's a pretty common thing.
That's what I was going to say. There's that one tweet that I really related to. It's like, how do lawyers just always argue without crying?
Practice. We had people who had severe like anxiety attacks, or people would actually start crying when they were speaking sometimes, and you just kind of have to practice it out of your system.
Do they lose
the debates? Yeah, if they cry?
is there deductions for that?
Yeah. I mean, speaker points, maybe you get rated on the argument and your style. I actually hired, oh my gosh, I don't think anybody I work with is ever going to hear this, because I don't think many of them listen to podcasts just altogether, but no. I hired a woman.
Nobody we work with listens to it either.
Yeah. He cried during both rounds of her interview process, and I still hired her, and she was one of my best hiring decisions. So I guess I have a lot more patience for that sort of thing than maybe some other people do.
Oh man. God.
So you enjoy like debating and arguing? Like, I don't get it, I guess. Like, how did you get into that?
So, I moved to the Oregon area when I was 15, and one of the requirements for my high school was a speech class, which most people took as sophomores, but I took as a junior. And through that course of that class, there were people in my class who were already on the speech team, and they heard me deliver what's called an oratory, which is a persuasive speech. And they said, you do the thing where you go down at the end of your sentences rather than upspeak. So convincing somebody and kind of like landing your point by drawing your volume and your pitch down. And they asked me to give it a try. So I joined for my senior year. I did a format. Well, I did a few different things. I did public debate, which is kind of like what you consider if you're watching a movie and there's a debate tournament happening, it's like 2 versus 2 or whatever. And then I did student Congress, where we actually like pretended being a legislature and like introduced bills and had to speak on behalf of bills.
I was in that youth in government.
And we had like, I still have gavels that I've won. That's what they gave us for prizes. Isn't that fun?
That's cute.
And I also did some individual events like impromptu speeches, where you're given a prompt and you have to start talking basically immediately, or prepared speeches, persuasive speeches, expository, where you're just telling people about a cool thing you like to talk about. And I caught the bug, and I decided that's all I ever wanted to do ever again.
Really?
And I started doing it all through college. The format of debate that I do, it has a couple different iterations, but it's essentially parliamentary debate, where, very long story short, you're kind of pretending to be like parliamentarians arguing with your colleagues and against your colleagues on particular initiatives or things like that.
Is it?
Man.
I mean, do you also enjoy when you have to take a position that you don't personally hold? Do you enjoy debating, like, maybe not on ethical things to you, but like just positions that you don't necessarily agree with?
I think that that's a really good thought exercise to better understand why you're on one side of a position, is to look at it comprehensively and actually see
that's
things.
That's how I became
side.
A leftist instead of a Republican. So.
Yeah. And that's one of the bigger challenges we had with some of our more successful debaters. When I was at my my last undergrad college, we had somebody who came in and he had to speak on in the defense of whaling as an industry. And he's like, this is indefensible. And it's like, isn't that the challenge, though? Finding a way to defend it, and finding a way to defend it that doesn't violate your own personal ethics. That's like ascension. That is, there are ways to do it.
Do you remember what the way was for whaling? Because I can't I you when you put it that way of just like trying to challenge yourself, it does occur to me like, oh yeah, of course, that's part of personal growth in general.
But, oh yeah, and you guys are both like vegetarians.
So
yeah,
no, totally Josh isn't. Josh eats so much bacon.
Oh, I meant Rob and you. Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like I can't imagine what the defense would be for whaling. Like I can't imagine what angle. Do you remember what angle?
Cultural.
Cultural, I guess, like cultural relativity.
I feel like that's like all you get. Because it's not like you can't say that's like for population control.
No, so there's definitely, especially in like northern Canada and northern Alaska, there are entire communities who coalesce around whaling as a cultural right, and it is a way of sustaining their food supply. Right. So there's a way to defend it. And I think finding that almost every issue has at least some aspect that is understandable and why people would side on the thing that you may not initially agree with. It's a very, you know, horizon broadening experience.
I was just thinking like going back a little bit earlier about how like lawyers like just sit there and like argue like almost unemotional. And then they just like go off later and like, and I was thinking about how the Supreme Court justices hang out together. Like, it doesn't even affect them past, like, getting back, like, the debate or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So unemotionally attached to it. I would find that impossible.
I think when you're in it to that degree, perhaps they, as professionals, feel it this way. You learn to compartmentalize it. So they take the work aspect of it and they realize that that's just that particular emotion, that particular behavior for that particular context. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made any friends with anybody outside of my own school when I was debating. And some of my best like long-term friends, like Josh and I were opponents in college, and that's how we met. Yeah. And we were like pretty serious rivals at the time too on the West Coast. Like we had like a begrudging respect for each other, but I don't know that we liked each other, but you know. You get through it. And, you know, after you get out of the actual environment, you realize how silly it kind of all is. And it's easier to be friends after that, too.
Right, especially when you're like not dealing with something like you don't have any power over any of this. It's like the Supreme Court where there is like a weird element there of like, I mean, they're not just sparring for fun. Like they are, but they also are insulated from any changes they make, really. But yeah, I mean, for you guys, it's like, like this is you at least have the same interests, the same hobby. So,
well, there's a critical analysis of debate that actually argues that there is a real world impact to it in a format of debate called policy debate, which I did not get near. There's a type of argument called a critique, which is saying things like, if you argue on behalf of vegetarianism, but you wear leather shoes in the debate round, that's a performative contradiction. So you cannot be trusted as a credible argumenter. But then some of the times they would argue that the rhetoric in the round, like if you were to say something like a nuke instead of a nuclear weapon, nuke speak, quote unquote, kind of takes away the seriousness of the gravity of nuclear weapons, and it makes it less scary as a prospect of like global nuclear annihilation. So yeah, we're a bunch of nerds, I guess.
So do you find like the structure of debate, is that like the appeal, or do you find that limiting?
I think that I find that as appealing for what I get out of debate, because if you don't have structure, you're just engaging in an argument, and it's so difficult to find out who actually wins the argument because it is typically a lot more emotional. Okay, says
Jen. Our most I would imagine that there's a very distinct difference between like debating and arguing because of that structure and the fact that, you know, it's that. These are rounds. These are kind of, this is a tiered, like controlled event. Mm-hmm. Like, do you find that a lot of people who like gravitate towards debate, are they personally argumentative? Is it more like appreciative of the kind of like the
oration?
What do you call it? The game, the strategy of it? I don't know.
There's a lot more variety of the type of person you get in debate than I think most people would expect. There are the people who are like inherently argumentative, like myself.
Right.
There are people who, a lot of theater kids get into debate, especially in high school, because individual events include like dramatic interpretation. And then they start to see that there's other stuff you can do that's not just the DI side of things. And then they start to get into some of the other speech formats, and then they start arguing. There are people who get into it just because it looks good for college applications when they're in high school and then they catch the bug. People are just curious about it. Curious, I think, in the same way that you all are. It's like, why would you, how do you do this without crying? And how do you argue on behalf of things you don't believe and things along those lines really do draw some curious folks to the activity.
How do you feel about like it seems like specifically there's a conservative debate culture that's sort of manifested online and in like the YouTube sphere, I guess more like C-lining usually to some extent, but it's just like that constant, like just wanting to debate people that don't talk to them. And also like Steven Crowder will do a thing where let's have like an unprepared college student on and then just like talk at them until they shut down. Ben Shapiro the same way, like they just keep talking at people until, and like talking really fast and talking over them. Like, how do you feel about debate sort of, like, I'm assuming they came out of debate. Do you know, like,
some of the people you have a real debate background that you'd be surprised by. Ted Cruz has a real debate background.
Clearly, yeah.
but I think that's one of my biggest pet peeves right now is the debate me, quote unquote, culture. And it's ostensibly a debate, I guess, because they're like showing up at a scheduled time and like they have their sides. But it's so disingenuous. One of the things that we talk about a lot on Indubitably is that in order to have like an effective debate, you need to agree on the rules of engagement. You need to have parameters on how far you're taking a specific topic. You need to make sure that time is allocated evenly. And you should probably have somebody evaluate it who's not actively in the debate themselves. Or in a lot of these cases, their own audience would be the ones evaluating the debate. So they probably have a preconceived like result before the debate even starts. So it's all fake. It's garbage. Yeah. And I think that's a really bad representation and misunderstanding of what debate actually is.
Mm.
Yeah, I guess it goes back to like Bill O'Reilly too. Like they all do the same thing still. Where once they start getting challenged too much, they're just like cut their mic. Just
it's like them. it's just browbeating. Disguised as debate.
Yeah,
that almost never happens in real debate. But there's one thing I did imagine, in competition. Yeah. No, it doesn't. It happens in debate, but only very rarely does it happen successfully. But I think it was like a quarterfinal round at a tournament, and it was against a team that I knew kind of well. And I just, they put up some really bad arguments and I can't remember what it was exactly about, but I went through and I refuted point, and it was just like devastating. And then I looked at them and I said, I expected more of you. That was probably the worst sportsmanship in the round that I've ever done.
Talking about professional, that's a pretty professional burn. Like, that's good.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
That's precision.
I feel like people like me, like maybe aren't suited for these more academic, intellectual sort of debates. Like, I don't know. Like, in my family, the winner is whoever was like the loudest, or like whoever, you know, like I don't know. The loser is whoever like gives in and is like, I can't do this shit anymore. And like
those are your terms of engagement then. you have your parameters for debate, and it's more like emotional and volume based.
Yeah. I mean, like, and like I'm still close to my family despite like not having much in common with them ideologically anymore. So like it's like, you know, I guess it's just been like I've been through so much therapy about it that like, you know, they can just say things and it doesn't bother me anymore. And I guess that's what happens when you, to an extent, when you're debating, that like you, if you're not as emotionally invested, then like it's probably even easier to debate. Though I choose not to argue with my parents anymore about ideological things, but like, you know, my mom will still text me occasionally, blah, 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 your lifestyle, like whatever. And like,
Jesus.
And I'm just like, you know, like, okay, mom, like, thanks.
She's like a fucking, it's like pro wrestling.
Yeah, my dad, yeah.
She's like,
that's my favorite form of debate.
It might be harder in some cases to debate against somebody that you have an emotional connection to, too, because the logic and the emotion blur so much.
Yeah. That's interesting. Did you ever have to debate against somebody that you were like really close friends with? I assume so.
Oh yeah. So the format of debate that we did, especially towards the end of my college career, you're actually doing two teams versus two teams. So you have eight debaters in the room, and depending on the size of the tournament, it was pretty common to have one of your other schools debate pairings in the round with you. So I would sometimes have to argue against my own teammates. I made a lot of really good friends in other colleges too, so I'd argue against them. Also, and I fortunately escaped the bulk of this because I was just so socially inept in college, but a lot of people dated each other in the circuit too. So people would be debating against their exes, or sometimes they'd have to drive around together with their ex, and it was just a whole thing.
Was it fun to watch at least?
There were some times I think that we saw people who clearly had an emotional charge to their arguments, especially in some of the more like prominent tournaments where they're debating like one of the final rounds on stage in front of everybody. You can kind of tell if there's an undercurrent of something else is going on here.
Oh, okay. Normally it isn't. There's how much of the debate in normal circumstances like would do you feel is like personal?
I think that's different for everybody. I think what my evolution was getting towards completely depersonalizing the debate to the point where I used to be so caught up in the arguments themselves and how they affected like my own ethics and behavior and whatever. And then I got caught up so much in whether or not I was winning and the emotional side of that. And then I think because I was in it so long and I got so jaded that I kind of got away from that entirely too, and thought of it again, just as like an intellectual exercise. Mm-hmm. So everybody's got their own relationship to it. I'm sure it's all over the place.
I feel like that's how I would do it, would be to like have like some kind of disconnect. That's how assassins do it.
Have you ever had your mind completely changed by a debate before?
No, I don't think so. I think one of the surprising things that happens in debate, if you're in it long enough, is you start to believe less. There are fewer positions you hold very strongly, and fewer things that you're extremely adamant about. But my value system hasn't really changed much since I was in my early 20s. So it codified the things I really do care about. And things that I have like less of an attachment to, I don't have a position, which makes debating on it even easier.
So you have like, I guess that's basically what you said. Like you have like your internal ethics, you have like your approach to everything, but like situation to situation, like whatever, I can't think of the term, but like legislation to legislation, it's just sort of like whatever. Basically, I don't know. Like where's the line of like when you stop caring, I guess.
Well, if it affects some of the things I hold as being like very paramount to my like identity, my personal ethics. So some of the things might be things like intersectional feminism. Like that's one of the only values I can think I've come out of debate more strongly understanding and holding. But I guess what might be surprising is that I softened my stance on something like gun control, because I think I was an absolutist before going into college debate. And then we actually have an episode on gun control and kind of doing an argumentative analysis of the positions of it. And Josh was like, oh, so you're probably for a total ban, right? And I said, no, I just want like reasonable gun laws that make sense so that like teenagers can't get a hold of semi-automatic weapons, but maybe like people can still have some access to firearms. It doesn't need to be that ridiculously restrictive. And so I guess maybe softening my stance on something like that or other arguments that might be quote unquote conservative was probably the biggest surprise for people who know me.
Did
I just make zero friends here?
No, not at all.
Brent is fully on your side, I know.
No, we're so far left.
Absolutely.
You go so far left, you get a little more gunsy anyway.
I mean, I am a gun owner, so. But I am also very much a leftist, so. It is fascinating, though. I like the idea of, like, just debate as kind of a... it almost sounds like when you talk about like the compartmentalization and the intellectual exercise, it almost sounds like also like a rhetorical exercise. That sounds fun. Is it like, when you prepare for a debate, do you kind of like flex a like literary muscle when you kind of like structure out your arguments, or?
I think it depends on the format of debate that you're doing, kind of how creative or how much of your mind you're going to use in the preparation for it. Mm. So the format of debate I was doing overall, like a parliamentary style, is also a format of extemporaneous debate, which means that we had 15 minutes to prepare. We would get the topic, we would get our position on it, or we get our position before we get the topic, but more or less we get 15 minutes to develop all the arguments we're going to be using in the round. No access to internet, which meant that I was printing out news articles and filing them in an accordion folder.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
That's warming.
So you kind of get into this, I don't know, fugue state where you're just like prep the arguments. And if you're in the second half of the debate, you have to think of a lot of different creative arguments to make sure that you do something different than what everybody else has already said in the round. So it's very much like a, I don't know, like that's the adrenaline of it, the kind of like blind panic of having to prepare that quickly. But then I guess when you're looking at, to prepare, a lot of teams do, they write debate briefs, which is to take like an issue that you might hear a lot about in the news and write up like a summary of what's going on there. What are some of the arguments on the pro side of, like if it's a piece of legislation, what are some of the cons? What are some thought leaders saying about this issue, blah, blah, blah. So you can get kind of creative with that, especially I think that's helpful for some of the debates that we hear over and over and over again to kind of break away from the very expected value trade-off. A lot of the trade-off is like privacy versus security. That's kind of boring after a while. So what are some other values that get traded off if you're talking about something like, I don't know, what having clear backpacks at school exclusively or something like that for students. I'm just pulling that out. But there's all those sorts of debate topics get distilled kind of into what their value trade-offs are. And yeah, you can use that and kind of build back up into a more creative avenue of argumentation after a while.
I mean, does anybody
I can see the appeal for that.
Yeah.
I can
see But does anybody ever get, like, because you're having to sort of construct these opinions in the moment and everything and construct all that, and I imagine some people are just not prepared. Do you ever just get, is it ever just exhausting, like dealing with people that are just sort of pedantic, just sort of like exhaustively talking about textbook definitions of things? And
yeah, you see that a lot with novice debaters. They do one of two things if they're really unprepared. One is they'll get up and they'll read the notes off of their paper that they prepared ahead of time. Like, we should make sure that the US does not send any more arms to Israel because having weapons is bad. And then they're like, thank you. And then they go sit down. Or they do the thing where they're like, I know I have 7 minutes to speak right now, and I'll be damned if I don't fill that entire 7 minutes. And so they just start like going into like ramble mode. And I, now that I've coached debate, high school and college debate, and I've been through like seeing all the novices, I just like think, oh, you poor thing, just be quiet. Yeah. Just stop.
This is giving me Model UN flashbacks.
I never did Model UN. That's one thing I wish I had gotten to do.
Yeah,
I had a lot of fun.
I think that was the opposite. I was in Model UN and it was horrifying. Yeah. I slept through my first debate. I didn't make it. And I got, I barely passed because of that.
I guess I'm curious now if it's possible to be a bad faith debater, because I feel like at times I've heard people that sound like they're just sort of playing devil's advocate, even though you're in a position where you don't really have to do that to make your argument. Like, if you just take a position, but there's still like a condescending sort of weird tone to it where they sound a little, I don't know.
Yeah. Condescending behaviors in debate are really common. A lot of people think they're smarter than they are. And then they walk out of the room while we're waiting for the judge to make their decision, and they just go like, nice game, and like shake hands, like the implication is, too bad you're not going to win this debate. Like, they just know that they're the winners of it. And they
shouldn't.
Yeah.
God.
I'd say there's two ways to approach debate as an activity. Like, it is a competition. Right. So it's hard to be bad faith in it if your objective is that you want to win, because then you're going to do whatever you strategically can get away with in order to win. There are some people who don't care about the W and they just want to have like the best possible discussion on a specific topic, whether or not that's a win or a loss. And I think that's kind of informed what Josh and I are doing on Indubitably, is because we're not like really debating. We do some debates, but that's just kind of like demonstration. We want to have the best discussion possible. So we're trying to get topics that people should know about, even though they don't listen to those episodes. Like, no one cares about the debt ceiling, apparently. we want to have the discussion that we think people should hear. And whether or not that's what's like popular or going to get the win, we're still going to do it to our own detriment sometimes.
Yeah. What's our top episode, Rob? What's our top episode, Rob?
I don't remember. It might have been AJ.
Is that really?
Maybe. I don't remember.
No.
I definitely noticed in your podcast though, like, it definitely isn't competitive. It's definitely just friendly. And is that generally, that seems like it'd be more enjoyable than competitive, but I don't know. Like, is the competitiveness part of the fun generally, or do you enjoy just having a low-key podcast where you can just sort of casually debate things without it getting heated and intense?
I think for what it is, it's enjoyable in this form. And if you haven't listened to any of our episodes where we actually do have debates on them, there are a few we do, like 3 or 4 a year, I'd say is probably our average. Those get a little bit more like actually competitive, but because we know it's not real, like there's no judge there, we kind of ask the audience to weigh in. I think that it is more like convivial than it would be in an actual tournament. When I was in debate and like caring so much about winning the debate, was also a period of my life where I was just like very angry all the time anyway. It was, you know, you're like 17 and going to college, which is already a bad idea because everybody else around you is not only an adult, but they can drink. And you're 17, and you can't cross state lines without your mom's permission. So going to tournaments is a difficult thing. And it's just like, and I want to win so badly because this is my form of validation. And now it's been a long time since I was in that stage. But the wins were, they fueled me for so long. And I wanted to win no matter what.
Wow.
Oh my God. That's like ruthless, but in a good way.
Yeah, that's
ruthless as a compliment.
Fascinating. Yeah,
I would have loved being called ruthless in college. Yeah.
I'm telling you, that assassin.
Do you have limits of the type of like positions you'll bring on though, or the type of people you'll bring on? Like, is there like a too far right sort of person that you don't want to have on?
You know, we are always looking for people to bring on who kind of encapsulate different thoughts than we do. Josh is more like liberal left, not as far like leaning, I think, as I am on the lefty side of things, mm-hmm. generally speaking. I mean, I think he would probably disagree with my characterization of him, but we do have guests that come on who can just kind of speak to a topic. And we've had one of, I think, our best discussions ever was when we brought on somebody who works for the Cato Institute. He's a libertarian, oh, really? To talk on immigration issues. And he's like, yeah, open borders, which is okay. Like unsurprising if you mm-hmm. like get a full idea of what the position is.
Right.
So if we had somebody who wanted to be on our podcast, having heard it, knowing who we are as people and still want to engage with that, who was on a completely different ideological plane than we were, I think we'd welcome that. If you know anybody who knows a lot about crypto, we needed to have a conversation about crypto at some point. We don't know anybody who's like,
type in the word crypto on Twitter, just say like, go public and be like, hey, we need a crypto guest to come on and your inbox will be flooded.
Oh yeah, they love to talk about
like
it.
Like throwing a slice of ham to the crabs.
Ham to the crabs.
Like, yeah, it's like throwing some ham to a bunch of crabs.
And you know where else I find a lot of crypto people? Because like I was looking for a new job for like 6 fucking months, basically. LinkedIn. You wouldn't believe, because LinkedIn is nothing but like bullshit, but like in a motivational poster way instead of like the evil way that's on Twitter. So it's just like, like people would talk about like, oh, the
business casual.
They're more like, oh, let's talk about Web3 and the future of what we're going to accomplish together. And AI is your friend, blah, blah, blah.
LinkedIn is bananas. I don't really need it much anymore because I'm probably staying with my employer for a very long time. But I log in every once in a while. I'm like, people are like using this like other people use Facebook. They're hanging out here.
Yes. Yeah. It's insane. Yeah.
But they all like one of you just said, I forget, but it's all like the business casual tone still. It's all like,
yeah,
inflated.
Remember that
there's a veneer to it.
Yeah.
Do you guys remember the marketing poster that I sent you where it was like Lollapalooza, but instead it was marketing terms?
Sounds horrible.
Absolutely did send it. Like, I don't remember what happened, but yeah, it would be like, hey, guess what? And it was just like, here's all the different things. And it was like, you know, like SEO, just like everyone. And I just couldn't believe that I was looking at that. I was like, somebody took all of their energy that could be used like making something like really funny, like a meme or like something really.
Oh, it's not a meme?
Really creative, and they made this fucking marketing lingo poster for LinkedIn.
It's like a real thing. It's not a meme. Like somebody didn't like make fun of the office speak for that.
Yeah.
No, I think holy it shit. Sounds like it's a meme for office speak psychos.
Yeah, it's a very insular meme.
Yeah.
Oh, and then the other thing you see on LinkedIn 100 times a day is like the dangers of remote work, like why you need to go back to the office. Just like,
that's ridiculous. I don't know. It's the pants industry lobbying.
Yeah,
be able to wear their pants out.
I just got an email before we started here saying I have an unread message on LinkedIn, so I clicked on it. Of course, it was just another promoted ad message they sent to me, but they don't tell you that.
I think the last time I updated my LinkedIn, I think like the most current job I have on there is the zine I had in college.
What was the zine?
It was called a remedial art class. I think I titled myself as co-king shit.
Well, you still got your new job at least.
Yeah, I have that. Yeah, that. Yeah, LinkedIn was not helpful in that.
Oh man, I'm trying to think. Did I get my new job on LinkedIn? I might have. Might have. Looked at. I was doing Indeed, Idealist, and LinkedIn, and I would cycle through them, and I would almost be like addicted to it. Like eventually, I just had to like. I would just have to like give myself breaks and be like, you know, I'm employed. It's not like I'm desperate. Mm. So like, I was employed the whole time, but I would just be like, you know. Like, just sit with this for a while and you can start again later.
That's a step up from Craigslist. I got a lot of employment from Craigslist.
Yeah.
That's where Nathan
consistently the worst employment.
Yeah.
Really?
Just awful. I met Rob there.
Oh yeah. I found that job there too.
I didn't even get it on Craigslist. A friend got me the job because he got it through Craigslist.
I got that job through Craigslist.
Yeah, I know. It's a Craigslist job.
You all got jobs on Craigslist?
I got a job on Craigslist once, too. Yeah, I was in the job for 3 years.
What, you were what for years?
I got a job through Craigslist to work in an insurance office. It was actually a pretty decent job.
That sounds
job.
Legitimate. Yeah.
Yeah, I know that there's a lot of sketchy stuff on Craigslist,
oh,
too.
Oh, I got a job writing college papers on Craigslist.
Oh, my gosh. That is something...
I still think about doing that now. Yeah, I loved it so much. It didn't pay very well. It was like per page or something like that, and you had to get like at least a B or above. But oh, it was phenomenal. Like I wrote a paper comparing the two different versions of The Ring, like the American awesome. Version. And the I was like, why would you outsource this? Why would you not want to write this paper? This is an incredible paper to write.
People hate it so much. I have written for people before, like exchanged like favors and whatnot. And I got my MBA last year and it was like, you think I would learn over time to maybe start my papers ahead of time, give myself the time. No, yeah. I was crapping out papers with like 5 hours before they were due.
Yeah.
And I think I could probably make a pretty penny if I do that professionally because I can somehow write very quickly. A research.
I can too.
You're still probably out there. Well, I guess it's AI now.
Yeah, I was going to say, I don't think it is anymore.
That's the one industry that's really from this.
For sure.
The cheating college paper industry.
They've got some sort of advanced, I guess, quote unquote, tools to try to determine how much of a written thing is AI generated.
Oh.
But so far, the only thing I've seen it successfully do is parse out that some TikTok creator's apology was written by AI.
Snorted.
Oh, man.
I mean,
that's a drop in the bucket, though.
I am curious how that works, because like it is just so bland, and I wonder if you can just like change a few words and pull it, or
in the
like,
future, anybody without a personality will just be shut.
Well, I think so much of AI right now is drawing off of source material out there, so you're kind of searching for plagiarism against existing material that got filtered. We're actually doing an episode on AI. AI art specifically, because of the writer's strike and the SAG strike, there's AI concerns for both of those types of unions.
Right.
But it's just interesting to think there can never be an absolute, at least not with current AI capabilities, an absolute elimination of the human element, because someone needs to still give the AI the prompt.
Right.
As soon as AI can self-prompt, we're done for.
I mean, like that. I've wondered about that though, because it feels like an Ouroboros. Like, where is the self prompt going? Like, unless they're just like, I feel like there's still to be a prompt somewhere along the line, like to tell me something, give me something new. I don't know, like, or else what's it doing? It's just spitting out a bunch of prompts into a file that somebody has to search through or something.
Yeah, AI will search through it itself.
I interviewed at some places that like were specifically looking for people to help create a database of marketing AI terms that it can just pump out, like you could marketing copy to the extent that you're just like, I'm selling sweaters at Walmart, and it comes out with like ads, like social copy, like commercial dialogue, like anything you can think of.
I mean, I use it in my job already when like they ask me like, hey, can you proofread this or make it look better? I'll try and do one pass, but then I'll just be like, I still feel like this is kind of weirdly worded. And I'll just throw in the ChatGPT and have it rewrite it for me.
Wow. I work for the state. We use programming from the 80s.
Like punch cards.
That's not a joke. Yeah.
Like, even in California?
Oh, yeah.
I remember that was one of the things Jon Stewart was yelling about on The Daily Show years ago, was like Obama's whole campaign was updating everything on the computers. Why the fuck is the VA still using paperwork for everything? Like, why isn't that ingenuity coming into the government with him?
I'm right now trying to figure out how to help go paperless. Been there a week.
How to do what?
How to get the office to go paperless.
Oh, I had to do that in my job a few years ago too, because there was a process that involved writing on a slip of paper, dropping it in someone's mailbox, and like once a week they would go check the mailbox and then process the request.
My God, like,
have you just consider email? Just consider email, please.
Rob, that sounds like Rob's nightmare at his job.
But paper airplanes are so fun to make. Like,
actually, at my job before my current owners took it over, the former owners, they would take online orders by, I guess they had a website still or something, but then they had a typewriter and they would type up the order and then take it next door to give to the people to bake it and send it off.
Oh my God.
What was that, like 2015, 2016?
Did you ever use a typewriter growing up? Like for like real things?
Who?
Like adult stuff.
Grandmother had one like as a gimmick, and I begged. Like I was like a and I knew very early that I wanted to be like a writer. And of course, I fancied myself, you know, like, oh, I'm gonna be the next who is it? Anyway, like I was gonna be like one of the Bronte sisters, like shit like that.
And
my grandmother wouldn't fucking give me that typewriter. She like, what? And this is the one who like later disowned me for being polyamorous. She's the only one who's still alive too.
Oh, then you can steal her typewriter. Like, there's no, like, yeah, just fucking take it. Yeah, what do you have to lose? I'm with you though. I have a typewriter specifically because of that. Like, yeah. I was like, oh, I want to be Marquez or whatever the fuck. But I remember I had to, like, I had to write. I remember writing book reports on a typewriter.
Oh, really?
Like on an electric typewriter. Yeah,
that sounds amazing.
We got a computer when I was 6 years old, so I never did.
Yeah, we didn't get a computer until I was like 12 or something.
Oh, we got a computer pretty early too, and one of the earliest memories I have is like, you know, my parents weren't computer people, but like they wanted it and they used it for like keeping up with people and stuff. We had like Windows. We had Windows 3.1, and then I think that was it, like 3.0 or 3.1. And we had a family email address until I was like 11 or 12. Can you imagine? It was
blank it out, obviously, Rob.
Freebird at mindspring.com.
That's awesome.
Mindspring hasn't existed for like 20 years. So,
yeah. Wow.
Take it back real quick. I am curious about one thing since you mentioned, since Kelly, you mentioned you're going to be doing AI, and I am curious what your guys' research looks like now with the internet and with something like as big and weird as AI. Like, how do you narrow down that research? Like, how, like, what sort of sources are you looking at for that?
Yeah, Josh and I do it at a very different way. If he does listen to this, which I'm sure he will, I will repeat what I've been repeating. Josh works so much harder on this show than I do. He not only does so much more of the like heavy lifting with prepping the debate episodes or prepping the outline for what we're going to be discussing, he does all of our editing too. So that makes the things pretty easy for me. He prefers to go for more traditional news sources. We actually just did an episode on citizen journalism and how it relates to more traditional journalism and kind of like the ethics of journalistic standards and what have you. And he talked a bit more about the things that he typically goes for when he's looking into an issue. So he prefers sources like the BBC, et cetera, a little bit more traditional, a little bit more solidly neutral on their ideological stances. Meanwhile, I am exclusively paying attention to social media because my mind has completely rotted. So I'll paste like tweets that I think are like, this is a really good example of the thing we're talking about. And then I'll talk a lot about TikTok and then he gets very annoyed with me. So we try to look for more traditional news sources with reputable, journalism and editorial standards so that we're not spouting like garbage when we're repeating some of the things that we hear from other people. He does so much more of the research than I do. The last episode we recorded was on just war theory, and I did more of the prep on that one than I have on any other episode in a while. And I could tell he was so happy I did that much work. Reputable sources if possible.
Yeah, because that's the other thing too, is like AI is also so, it's still like not even a well-defined concept. Well, I guess you guys have your angle of generative art, but yeah. it's all new. Like, you can't like go back into archives really and find much, can you, on something like that?
I haven't done too much of a deep dive on more of it kind of holistically, because there is so much about AI that is separate from the art side of it. Like, AI is going to power how industry runs and how, I don't know, planes are designed, things that are just outside of the scope of what we've even considered. Right. But I think we are looking at where is the actual controversy right now? And we're playing with these like fun AI art generators and like, oh, I can make it look like drag queens are climbing Mount Everest because of AI. This is so fun. And then like, oh, this is probably taking someone's job. Uh-oh. we have an episode on universal basic income, which is kind of a response to automation, that if everything becomes automated, there are not going to be jobs anymore. There just won't be some sort of like new deal, dig ditches for the government to make money type of thing happening. Jesus. So there's got to be a way to feed people. And I think AI is the next venue in which that conversation is appropriate. If this takes away that many jobs, society will collapse and people will not be able to feed themselves. So what are we going to do to take care of the fact that there are still humans on this planet?
I bet Brandon has a few ideas.
I do.
Soylent like Green.
It's just a Star Trek future, right? I mean, just... there's no more scarcity, so you just
but we got to get there somehow. You got to get there somehow, and we got to crack a few eggs to make an omelet, you know.
No, it's there's nothing to do on Earth, so everybody just kind of like lives and doesn't have any jobs, but everybody else is out like harvesting minerals from the asteroid belts. That's our future, but we're not quite there
yet. Oh, yeah, probably said all the immigrants at the space then.
Oh my god, intergalactic
slavery, yeah.
I saw something awful yesterday. I saw something really awful yesterday with AI art, and it took me like a few minutes to like see what I was looking at, but like somebody posted like 10 AI generated photos of Sinead O'Connor like as an angel.
Oh my god, the poor woman. Let her rest in peace.
Goodness gracious. It took me a while. I was like, is this what I'm looking at? And I was like, oh my god.
Yeah. I don't know.
Not
I don't know how
AI art happened like right after 9/11 with all like, the crying eagle motifs and whatnot.
My god. You know, I remember like people already saying back then, you know, we all remember 9/11.
Never forget.
Yeah, does anybody remember like when people were saying that like they like I could see Satan's face in the smoke.
Yes!
Yes. Like, I remember that. I couldn't see it. I don't know what the hell they were talking about.
I actually did see a good inoffensive 9/11 joke recently. Like an inoffensive one, yeah. The person said they were watching the news and they said this is the worst air quality has been in New York in 20 years or 21 years. And he's like, oh, what happened 21 years ago? And he's like, oh, it was 9/11.
Yeah.
I forgot.
Wait. Ah, you never forget.
You're not supposed to forget. That's
the
one. Take it
to the corner. Yeah. You never forget. There's one thing you can't forget. Can't forget this thing.
Yeah.
I remember like somebody, like an older relative of mine who was like on Facebook and stuff, was big on never forget, but instead of 9/11 it was Pearl Harbor. So like every like December 7th, I guess this, and I can't remember if he was even in the military. He definitely wasn't like old enough to have like been serving or anything, but he was just like, never forget Pearl Harbor. Like it's December 7th. Like I can't even remember. It is December 7th.
It is December 7th.
Okay. Many times. On his history test that he's just traumatized now.
Yeah, right.